Today's episode of The Thriller Zone is sponsored by Blackstone Publishing and the brilliant new techno thriller 4 Minutes by the number one internationally best-selling author duo, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. 4 Minutes is available now from your favorite bookseller.
Hello, and welcome to The Thriller Zone, the podcast for thriller seekers everywhere. I'm your guest host, Tammy Temple, and on this evening's podcast is David Temple, our guest, who is launching today The Imposter, the second book in the Pat Norelli series. Tell me, David, what does it feel like to be on the opposite end of the conversation?
It's completely different because I like being on this side where I start off telling about what the show's going to be about and who we're going to be speaking it with. But yeah, it's a little bit different, especially when it is my lovely wife.
A little nervous?
Oh, just a wee bit.
For the audience, we have not rehearsed this. David is not aware of my questions, and I have taken full control of his podcast. Which tells you a little bit of something about him.
Yeah.
There's a huge trust value in that I'm taking control, and also that he likes to have a fair amount of control over his podcasts. He's very particular and clearly a professional.
Thank you.
So, what is special about today, David?
Well, I launched The Imposter, book 2 in the Pat Norelli series, and I'm really excited about this particular book because it's a slight departure in that it picks up 1 year later. You know, when I set out to do The Poser, which was book 1, I wasn't sure if it was going to be pure thriller, pure mystery, and it ended up being a little bit of both. I was very happy with that book. We had great sales. And then I thought, how can I make it better? So here on the day of, I've sold not as many as I would like, even with all my social pimping, but, you know, it's all part of the process.
You have very high expectations, and you've done a great job in your sales for today. Let's talk a little bit about, for people that are out there listening to this podcast, let's step back and share with the audience, because I'd like for them to feel the interest, the enthusiasm, opportunity to engage with how the Pat Norelli series came to life.
It was originally going to be Pete Norelli, if you want to know the truth. I had this guy in mind, and I came up with Norelli, Italian, Pete, because it was an average guy name. And I got the opening scene within minutes. This is an opening scene that I wrote in 1997 in one take. It's about a page long. Very gripping scene. And I just put it on the shelf. It wasn't until however many years later that I ran into an agent at an event at Writer's Digest in Los Angeles, and she said, hey, what would you think about making it a woman as the lead protagonist? And I'm like, that's interesting, and I got no problem with that. And within minutes of sitting down and looking at the script, I'm like, oh, Pat, Pete and Pat, of course, brother, sister, because I had this germ of an idea of a sister when it was Pete, and it was based in Palm Springs, outside of L.A. But it's funny, the wife remained the same, and he originally had one daughter. He has now 2 children, which I can go into later, why I named them what I named them. And so when she made that suggestion, I'm like, okay, I can do that. And I retooled the whole story. Took me a couple of years, and it was way too fat. And when I followed up, she said, you know, it needs to be about half of that. Well, the mystery was built upon this series of dominoes. So if you pulled out one domino, it might not trip the next one. So I had to kind of restructure it, but that's how it started. And then when I started, when I committed to it being a woman, I saw her, I heard her, and I had her instantly. And she's as real to me, almost as real as you sitting there right now.
There are a few things that come to mind about this story. And I recall it was in the fall of 2016 when you you went to the Writer's Digest conference.
Right.
You came home and you were excited about the possibility of crafting your first mystery.
Yeah.
And that in itself, because you had basically been writing, I call them military thrillers. I'm not in your world. What would you call them?
They are military thrillers. I mean, they're not Vince Flynn and Jack Carr and Tom Clancy, but it was a version of that. And it was Carter Matheson, this guy that I just kind of dreamt up one day that I had developed in another story. And everyone was so drawn to him that I just kept going with him. But he's, you know, I've always liked the character that is a man's man, off the reservation, wants to go his own way. He has his own agenda. It's often about revenge or retribution or redemption, the three R's. And he comes out of retirement to take on a special project. Kind of cliche in that everybody does that, but I had just started writing like full time, and I thought that's what I wanted to do, and I came up with him, and it just kind of fit.
So the Carter Matheson stories were quick reads. They were really interesting. It felt like you embraced that character, and the writing was very natural for you. So to leap into a mystery and now writing in a female voice, you referenced it took you a couple of years to complete the first of the Norelli series. And that feels like having to get your head wrapped around. Now you're writing a mystery, creating an outline for all of the red herrings, and then writing from a female voice.
That was the hardest part because, I mean, having grown up with two sisters and a mom and then dating my fair share, I had a pretty good handle on what women were about. But I had never crawled inside the mind of a woman to write as the protagonist. So that was a challenge. And I got called out on a lot of different things. But, you know, I always want to say this. Like to people who, I had someone say to me early about another book, kids wouldn't talk that way. And to this day, I go, when you sit down and write your book, you can decide how that kid talks in your world. Right now, this is how they talk in my world. And I think that's completely fair.
It's your book.
Right, exactly.
It's your story.
Right.
And to your point, however you want to portray the story is your choice.
Yeah, and I always thought it would be, you know, Norelli is a whole lot like you. She's beautiful. She's smart. She doesn't take shit from anybody. She is kind and considerate, way softer than you think she is. But again, she's not going to be pushed around, especially in a man's world of like the LAPD. She's going to prove herself. She's got a brother, an older brother, who leaped ahead of her in the career. She's got a father who's domineering, former military, both of them. And, you know, she's always proven herself. And I just thought it would be really cool to have, you know, I remember saying in a blurb on one of my social media ads way back when, like, if you took Bosch and gave him really great legs and made him a beautiful brunette, that would be Norelli. Oh my God, that's so sick. Thank
so
you.
Titus would not play Norelli.
Titus Welliver, I love you, buddy. I mean, brother. But yeah, no, I need her. Like he must be about 5'6", 5'7". She's like 5'10", 5'11", legs up to here, and just brunette, beautiful like you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
High level. Give me an overview of the Pat Norelli story, book one, book two, just because we might have some people that aren't necessarily familiar with the Pat Norelli series?
Super easy. Pat Norelli is working the late shift. Thank you, Michael Conley. Third shift, overnights. She gets a chance to work with a mentor that had moved in and out of third to first shift called Detective Stuart Brown. A murder case comes in Hollywood. A starlet is found murdered. She gets, because she's coming off the shift, she teams up with Stuart. They go see the evidence. Everyone's going, oh yeah, suicide. And something about it just strikes her as not right. So she watched patterns and habits, and she went to her boss and said, look, give me this case. Just let me prove myself. If I don't do it, you can fire me. It's a Hail Mary. And he's like, you're a pain in the ass. Yeah, okay, we'll do it. She takes the case, and between her and Stuart Brown, they crack it. It takes a while. It's full of really interesting characters. The Poser's probably one of my favorite books I've ever written. And so they crack it. However, spoiler alert, he gets away. So 1 year later, having haunted her, and him having haunted her in her dreams, she sets out to remedy the situation.
Track him down.
So the imposter, without giving away too much, the story opens with her connecting with a friend. That friend turns up dead, and somehow the evidence points to Norelli. Norelli's like, this, that's total BS, and I think I know the signature of this person. And lays it all on Red 26 and says, I'm going after this guy. This is right before she's told, oh, and don't leave town.
So she's fighting for her freedom.
Yeah.
She's fighting for her career.
Yes.
And then she has this personal vendetta to take down this guy that has wreaked so much havoc in her life and in her personal friendships.
Yeah, and what makes the first story so interesting is she is going about her business. She's got a little bit of a drinking problem. She's got a little bit of a promiscuity problem, we'll call it. And her boss, the captain, says, look, why don't you just try to dial this in and go get some help? And she dials into this particular therapist, and he isn't what he appears. And, you know, part of his magic is being able to get inside the psyche of someone. And he has a couple of different tricks up his sleeve. And P.S., this is all based on research. It's all legitimate. All of it's doable. This is not, you know, a fantasy book. And then, you know, with book two, he can't get her out of his head as much as she can't get him out of his head, for whatever reason you want to say it is. And so she rolls the dice, throws a Hail Mary, and goes after him. And it's an international chase.
You mentioned research, and the story is not some pie in the sky imaginary scenarios. Tell your audience a little bit about the research that you go through to create or to bring your books to life.
Well, first of all, I love me some Google flyovers. I learned this trick when I was living in Manhattan. So we had the good fortune to be able to live in Midtown, and then I would go from coffee shop to just write. But as I would sit on particular corners, I would look at the buildings around me, and then I would envision what those buildings would be in my story. And then I would, you know, I discovered Google flyovers, and then I could actually fly over the city, and that would expedite my story. So I use that technique in this particular story, The Imposter. And I have this fascination, for whatever reason, with Australia, and I just love it. I've never been there. It's so much like a lot of the parts of America. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to use that as one of the home bases. So that becomes part of my research. And I go into great detail, the hotels and the restaurants even the cabbies, it all has to be real, so that if anyone is living inside Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane, they can say, oh, the guy knows what he's talking about. And then, having lived in Manhattan, both of us together, and then me one other time doing a radio show, you know, I know that city really well. So I like to integrate restaurants and streets and avenues. I did that in Knuckle Down with Carter Matheson, being able to tell so many different things terrain-wise and otherwise. But I really like to make the story as real as I get right up to the edge of reality, and then I bend the truth. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I've read your reviews. Yeah. People do speak to the fact that reading your stories, they feel like they know the areas that you write about.
Yeah. I take very little liberties with that. And I, if I bend anything, I will, you know, logically, I might name the restaurant something differently in case they don't want to be mentioned, or, you know, and I'll take certain liberties with that, and I'll embellish tiny things. But I really do like to stick, for whatever reason, as close to it as possible.
I will say that our bookshelves have swelled significantly over the course of the last few years, from books on forensics, AI, several things that I never would have thought would be in my book library are all of a sudden in our library, based upon all of the research that you do.
Yeah, there's a guy that I met at Thriller Fest in 2019, and I'm going to drop his name right now. For some reason, I can't recall it. He's so well known, so I feel like a complete idiot. But he's big into forensics, so I picked up a Forensics for Dummies because I knew that I had never been to an autopsy. I'd never seen a lot of those things. I'm going to go to that eventually, but I just didn't really have the stomach for it, and I needed to learn a lot of things really fast, so I picked up that book. But yeah, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, which is going to be featured in my next book, and I've already started reaching out to cybersecurity specialists. But you know, I've seen all the greats do this. Don Winslow, one of my favorite authors. Jack Carr is probably off the charts with his research. He takes it to a biblical level. I don't even know what that means, but it's pretty crazy. Meg Gardner will do things with words that I had never seen, so I have become a lover of the thesaurus. But yeah, I do spend quite a bit of time investing in books that can expand my knowledge base and inspiration as well as anything.
I noticed too, as it pertains to those particular authors and a few other authors, you'll walk out of your office and you'll make me stop what I'm doing and give me a sentence. And we'll kind of hang on that sentence. Like, wow, what a well-crafted sentence.
Yeah.
It kind of is an art. I never really thought about that until we started going down this road. And words and sentence and structure and meaning became very prevalent in our conversations.
Yeah, Cormac McCarthy has a way of crafting a sentence with no punctuation, by the way, which is a little off-putting, that you won't ever really cognitively think of. Probably one of my favorite authors for this specific thing, and I'm so excited to say she's going to be on a future show, is Meg Gardner. She can craft a sentence that is so rich and so colorful and vibrant, that uses words in such a way that I'd never heard, that I'm completely mesmerized. And, you know, there are people who say, write what you know. I've always heard that, but I also like to write what I don't know, because I like the discovery. The discovery to me is half the pleasure. However, with that said, I do know I've learned a few things over the last few books, and I think I posted this in Instagram or Twitter recently about now I get it why when I went to pitch what was Seduction at Daybreak is now The Poser. to some agents in New York because they already have that premise out there. So now I'm starting to get the feeling, especially after talking to KJ Howe of Skyjack fame, and she said that she had learned from David Morrell that you write, truly do write from your experience base, and that's why this next book is going to be so significantly different.
I don't want to lose sight on a couple questions about Norelli, but I do, before I go back there, I do want to call this one example out because I think it's important as other writers are listening about maybe what works, what has worked for you, advice that you've received. You had an experience with Tony Eldridge, the producer of the Equalizer series.
Yeah, yeah.
And share that story because I think it's significant for what you just said.
Yeah, so I'm at Thriller Fest and you get to pitch agents or producers and I sit down to Tony, a super nice guy, very talented, did all the Equalizers, like you said, and his wife, Tori's really a talented writer as well. And so we're sitting there and I'm talking about the pitch and this is what's so key. I do the pitch and he goes, he almost started tuning out instantly. And I, what's up, Tony?
And this is the pitch for Pat Norelli.
This is for Pat Norelli.
Series.
Yeah, for the series. And he goes, yeah, no, it's not for me. And I'm like, well, why is that? He goes, been there, done it, seen it. A lot of stories. And then I start citing all the stories that I can think of. Wait a minute. So Bosch? Well, yeah, but that's Michael Conley. Okay. But, you know, I named a few others. He goes, have you been a detective? I'm like, no. Have you been a cop? No. Forensics? No. He says, okay, well, listen, thanks for your time. And I get ready to leave. And he goes, by the way, what's your background? I said, I'm a former radio guy. I did radio shows for like 25 years, like all the major markets. That was my love. He goes, why don't you write about that? I'm like, who wants to hear about that? And he goes, I would. He goes, I'd buy that right now. And I'm like, oh my God. And I reflected back to a moment when you had made this comment about, you know, why don't you write exactly what your background is? And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And at that moment, I went, okay, well, that would make sense because I know a whole lot about that. And then I mentioned this to KJ Howe on an early Naked Monday podcast. And she completely took off on that and said, yeah, 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 yeah. And then my favorite moment of this year, you and I are having lunch with Don and his wife, Jean, Don Winslow, and right here in, you know, Encinitas. And he makes a comment about, you know, what are you working on? I'm like, well, I think I'm going to do this story next about such and such. And he goes, what would it involve around? I'm like, you know, radio. He goes, oh, my God, I love radio. Radio is one of my favorite mediums. I just need that, blah, blah, blah. And he went on and on. I'm like, wow. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to incorporate my career of radio into that. He goes, I love it. What's the title? And I told him, which I won't mention. And he goes, oh, my God, that's great. And at that moment, it all just kind of crystallized. I mean, between you and KJ and him. And I'm just, you know, sometimes you just have to get something beat into your head a couple of times. And then I'm like, okay, that's it. And so I'm going to put Norelli a little bit to the side. I'm not getting rid of her or Carter. But this other is burning a hole in my brain. And I've got plenty of material on it. I mean, 25 years of a professional career. And I've thought about it for decades. So that'll be next.
You just also landed on a question that I was going to ask you. So for everyone out there who, what I've heard is women want to be her, guys want to date her. What's next for Pat?
That's such a great question. I have one of two thoughts. If you read the story, you'll find out that there has been some seismic shifts in her life. Seismic. From boyfriends to her parents moving to her daughter going away to college. And I have a very specific idea in mind that I want to do with her next. And if you read The Imposter, well, if you read The Poser, you'll get a sense of her journey, her broken journey. In the imposter, you see that she's starting to come to terms with a lot of things about herself. And then there's a few things she loses very close to her in the story that shift her in a seismic way. And having grown up in Los Angeles, born in Pasadena area, and I think there is a possibility that there may be a very big change in the horizon. Is that what you're getting at, little missing?
I think it's important for people to understand your audience who like Pat, or maybe your audience who has yet to read Pat, have an understanding of what's in store. And it sounds as though you're going to kind of pin it for a bit so you can work on this other project and then potentially come back and breathe a little more life into her story.
I have a very specific idea where I want to take her and what I want her to do and how I want to integrate the people around her into her new life while she says goodbye to some people. But just like life, and you and I know this because we've moved how many times in our years together, life just has a way of constantly evolving and taking on new shifts and patterns. And she's going to do that. I'm very excited about it. I mean, I've got some really significant ideas for her. And here's another thing I did in this book that I've never done anywhere else, is I bring in characters from other books and other series into the story. A major one shows up in The Imposter that wasn't in The Poser, and he came from another series. And then as I'm going through the book, I wrote this one-off called Devour earlier in the year about a celebrity chef in San Francisco. I won't go into that whole story, but I brought in a little elements of that story into this book. And I love doing that because I think what's key is if people find you and they like you and they like your characters and they stick with you. Your stepmother said something about, I love the fact that you brought in this character from another world into this new world. She goes, that's so exciting because I had already pictured that person in that world. And now to see them integrate into this world was really interesting. I just think that's cool.
And potentially a unique style.
Yes.
So for everyone out there that's listening, before we wrap up segment one and go into segment two, who is your ideal audience for Pat?
I would say women who are excited about hearing about women heroes. You know, I had a very strong mother. I have very strong sisters. You're a very strong woman. I like strong women. I like to see, I love this new wave of women in television and films being the ass kickers, like Mayor of Easttown, right? I mean, characters like that. I love that. And it's about time. So I really like that. And I would like to see more of that. Does that?
One of the things that I have enjoyed about watching Pat is there's a little rough and tumble to her in the first book. And
she got a little softer in book two.
Yeah, I think it's nice to have a strong female presence. And I think in the past, at least what I've grown up around, is you're soft and marshmallow, or you're snarky and you're just not a nice person. You're just kind of brash and edgy. There's no middle of the road where you can be feminine and strong and have boundaries, but you don't have to be rude and crass.
Right.
There's a little rough and tumble to her in the first book, but I agree with you. I saw that soften a bit in also, the second book.
Yeah, and it has to do with vulnerability because she was rolling from situation to situation and, you know, trying to fit in and try to be accepted. And I think it's a vulnerability thing that when she gets close to someone and she realizes she can truly just be her and she's accepted as herself and she sees that that's okay, then she goes, oh, they like me just the way I am. I don't have to try so hard. Again, it's the male influence of work, male influence of brother, of father, etc. And so she's doing that competitiveness. But when she realizes that the guys, you know, like the soft side, it kind of works. And so back to your question about audience, I'm amazed at the amount of guys, your brother, for one, your brother just freaked out. He loves Norelli. He's always, I love me some Norelli. And, you know, back to your comment about girls want to be her and guys want to date her. So, you know, that, I don't know, 25 to 55, men and women, men and women, because everybody kind of likes her.
And to your point, I think as a reader, you find an author that speaks to you and you just tend to read through their books, regardless of the topic.
Uh-huh.
My mother's not 25 to 55 and she really likes your writing. My stepmother isn't 25 to 55 and she likes your writing. My whole family basically reads David's work and really enjoys it. Men, women of all ages.
And I think it's funny, the reason I brought up that, I was just having to fill this out for a Facebook ad or something, and they said pick the age group, and I just kind of picked 25 to 55 because it started with 13. I'm like, 13-year-olds are not going to be reading this book, and it went to 85, and I'm like, 85 is not going to be reading this book. My mother would not have liked this book, God rest her soul. Your mother wants more sex than I've ever been able to write. And I hope she did like this one, didn't she? She liked a little, yeah. She always wants more.
Yeah. So before we transition to segment two, how can people find you? How can people purchase your books?
Easiest way to go to my website, davidtemplebooks.com. Kind of makes sense. There you can find out how to purchase the books, how to purchase the audiobooks. You can find out about my background a little bit and read some testimonials from people who have read the books and have liked it. I've discovered this new thing. It's a new version of Bitly. You know what Bitly is? It's basically a URL shortener. And there's a new one called Sleek Bio, which is kind of nice. Because everybody wants to shorten everything. So bio, biography, sleek, sexy, simple. So sleek.bio/David Temple kind of gives, I'm using that on my branding now so that you can go there and in one simple little page, you can connect with me on every single channel. So if you don't want to sit there and go through my website, which is pretty gorgeous, if I may say so myself. Thank you, Author Bites. Then that's a fair way to do it. But Amazon, I know that The Imposter is on Amazon right now. There was a little bit of a technical difficulty, so it's not going to hit all the other booksellers until Friday or Saturday of this weekend. But I do know the paperback is on both Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and the ebook is on Amazon. But it should all be across the board, Apple, Google, blah-de-blah.
Social media. What are your social media sites where people can be a fan, follow what you're doing, what you're saying, your writing practices, tricks, tips?
Yeah, I don't really do tips and tricks. I'll leave that to other professionals. But Dave Temple is Twitter, at Dave Temple. And Dave Temple is because everybody called me Dave growing up, so I guess it was too much to say David. It took so much longer to say two syllables. Instagram is David Temple Author. And I've just launched a new podcast, which is The Thriller Zone. So at Thriller, The Thriller Zone. And that's been taken off. That thing has grown so fast in such a short amount of time. And I love somebody said to me the other day, why do you love podcasts so much? And I said, well, let's see. I grew up since I was 13. I started dreaming of being on the radio. I had my first job at 15. I had my first radio job at 16. And then I just catapulted from there because that's all I wanted. And that is my number one favorite thing. It's always been my number one favorite thing. And so the Thriller Zone, I've jumped into that with 2 feet, and I'm not looking back. Naked Monday has been fun, and I'll come back around to that every once in a while. But for branding sake, I'm just sticking with the Thriller Zone. What else?
Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. People can find you there.
Yeah, David E. Temple. I don't really spend much time there. I've got a huge network there, but I don't know why I just don't spend much time there. And then Facebook, but I'll be honest with you, honey. Facebook confounds me a little bit. It confuses me. It's changed so much since, you know, the early days, like 10 years ago, I was way too obsessed, spent way too much time there. And now I don't. It's confusing to me, but I'll get back to it. You're very good at that, so I'll ask for your help.
Okay, so we've covered Pat Norelli, the poser, the imposter, which launched today. Congratulations to great sales.
Thank you.
We know where to find you on your website. We know how to buy that book, and we know how to connect with you on social media platforms. Mm-hmm. Anything else that you'd like to share with us before we move into the next part of the Thriller Zone?
I would say I would give great words of encouragement. I have recently made friends with a gentleman, Eric Bishop, who is writing, has a book called The Body Man. And I want to say to the writing community to surround yourself with mentors. I met Jack Carr early on, just before he blew up. And I've watched him from afar, and I'm in such high admiration of his talents. Eric Bishop is on the edge of blowing up with The Body Man. That's coming out in November. And I dip in and out of other social sites where I get to communicate with guys like Don Winslow and Harlan Coben and Don Bentley. And I would say the best thing you can do, well, the number one thing you should be doing is writing. I mean, if you're not writing, then you're not a writer and you'll never get anywhere. The second thing is kind of surround yourself with people who believe in you and encourage you and support you. And thirdly, of course, surround yourself with loved ones like you, friends and family who, when the going gets tough, they'll go hang in there. Because, you know, I'm from a career that was surrounded by a lot of high-profile personalities in the spotlight, New York, L.A., Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and on TV, radio, film. And it's a very heady experience. And when you're taken out of that, it can be its own situation. But then you transfer into writing where it's solitary and you can go weeks and months without a lot of interaction. It will change you. And I just think it's my word of encouragement is to find people and find things like Thriller Fest that KJ Howe runs out of New York, and all these different writing conferences, and get involved in them, Boucheron and things like that, and absorb yourself. I mean, I learned more in, how many days was I in New York? Like 3-4 days?
No, you were there for, I want to say it was just shy of a week.
Yeah, I learned more and did more networking than probably any other time in my life, almost. And I would just encourage that.
And that was the Thriller Fest.
Thriller Fest.
Which is also doing virtual events until they feel comfortable to move back into a face-to-face gathering.
They're doing one right now. I actually made a comment on social media about that. Several people told me how to be able to access that video footage and so forth. And I would highly encourage you, ITW, I mean, International Thriller Writers is the group, and it's worth every single penny. Tell KJ I sent you and get a percent discount or something. Anyway, it's just amazing to do that. And the support group is phenomenal.
What was the best money you ever spent as a writer?
The best money I ever spent as a writer. Thriller Fest. I met amazing people. The thing that was so cool is you sit at home and you read all these books and you really are absorbed by them. And then you get to sit down with those authors. John Sanford. I get to hang out with John Sanford. I've been reading John Sanford, the Prey series, since college. I mean, that's just amazing. And then, again, the networking. Merrill Moss of Merrill Moss Media that hooked me up with BookTrib that did some reviews for me and did some publication for me this week. I met a great guy out of Australia, James Gregory. We've become, he was one of my first podcasts on Naked Monday, and he's a former, former detective turned writer. Frank Safiro is a cop up in, I'm sitting here going, is it Seattle or is it Oregon? And just meeting people and networking. And this is before COVID. So, yeah, back to the thing about bringing it back. I think they're going to bring it back in the next year or so. I hope. There's nothing like hanging around person to person at events like that.
So conferences, the right conference for your genre, would be the best investment, one of the best investments that a writer can make.
100%. For so many different reasons. And there's something about getting away to an environment that is nothing like the one that you're in that allows you to kind of like wipe the slate clean and you're fully immersed in it. There's nothing quite like it.
You've named several authors during the podcast. What other authors are your friends or are you friends with? And how do they help you become a better writer?
I think it sounds kind of cliche, but the encouragement, because it's not an easy job to create worlds out of thin air, and the competition gets harder and harder every year because there are more and more people who think they can write. So the market is inundated with every Tom, Dick, and Harry who tries to write a story. So the camaraderie, there's a couple of people that I can think of that just like, well, Eric Bishop today, we were just chatting back and forth and he said, hang in there, I believe in you. And I'm like, oh my God. I mean, we've only become recent friends. And Andrews Wilson, those guys just instantly kind of took me under their wings. And Jack Carr, who's just become a beast, you know, and I still drop him a note and he'll respond. And he's so kind and gracious. And while he's blowing up, he doesn't forget all the people along the way. And then, like I mentioned, Don Winslow. You meet Don and Don's a megastar. I made this comment to you one day, and it's kind of hilarious. I don't think I've ever told anyone publicly this, but, you know, in my radio career, I hung out with rock stars and country music stars and pop stars. I mean, you name them, I hung out with them, and actors and actresses because I was on movie sets. And I never really went out of my way to get photographs or autographs or any of that because it was just like, you know, whatever. But now I meet writers for whatever reason now at my age and they've become kind of my new rock stars, and it's because of admiration. I don't want to be them. I don't want to I'm not star sucking up, and I really admire their craft and the way they've led their lives, and they're kind of in my later years, they're my rock stars, and I just totally dig that. And I learned so much. Like, I can rattle off 5 books right now that I've read and have shifted the way that I look at writing. And one I read recently, The Gentleman's Hour by Don Winslow. I don't know how many times I talk about this, but I read that a couple of years ago, and I just, for whatever reason, I read it again. I'm like, this is like a perfect book. So Stephen King said if something along the lines, if you're not reading, you're not writing. I mean, he's in his book on writing, he's just always talking about you've got to be reading.
What do you think is the biggest misconception out there about writers and what it takes to make it and what it looks like when an author is discovered?
Well, I think a big misconception is I think people see, oh, so-and-so wrote a good book, and then all of a sudden they sold the rights and they're millionaires. You know, I think of T.J. Newman, who is a recent discovery, and she wrote the book Falling, and I got introduced to her by Don. And that book was amazing. Flight attendant, young flight attendant, who had a dream of a story and wrote it on cocktail napkins and put it out to 40 agents and got turned down 40 times until it got in the hands of Shane Salerno, another secret hero of mine. And he turned her life around, and she got a book deal and turned around and got a movie deal. So I think there's a little misconception that people think, oh, it's that easy. No, it's 40 rejections, and I think that's a low number, and that's a misconception. And I think people always ask me, what's your number one secret? I'm like, it's seat time. It's putting your ass in the chair. I mean, I try to get up somewhere between 5 and 6 every single day, 5 days a week, and sit down and write. And that's what it takes. It's the discipline of constantly doing it. I think it's a combination of constantly doing it. And with time, it's, you know, Malcolm Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours. By the time you do that, you have gotten to where you're halfway decent. So it's part discipline. You're honing your process, and hopefully you're learning along the way.
Well, and a lot of people don't take into consideration, I imagine, the 10,000 hours, the number of years that it actually took for, in this particular example, with the book The Falling, you know, for her to really write that story and have it be in a place where she could present it. That's just not something that happens in 30 days. It's hours and hours, yeah, and years of crafting.
It's years, yeah. I mean, look, my very first book, right, that I want to say it was 2008, 2009, when self-publishing was just getting started. And it was a little book called Chasing Grace, and I grew up in a religious home, so I thought, oh, that'd be interesting to write a story kind of like that. And so I crafted it. And, you know, it had some pretty decent sales, but it wasn't until because I'm a closet filmmaker, I said, look, I want to turn that into a screenplay. I'd never written a screenplay, so I wrote a screenplay. And I was like, well, I want to turn it into a movie. Never made a movie. Bunch of shorts, but not a movie. Went out and raised the money. And then shot it, directed it, starred in it, and sold it to Word when it's on Amazon and Netflix. And to be able to sit at home and watch a movie on the screen that you had an idea of, how many years ago was that? And a lot of suffering along the way, as you very well know, which we won't go into. And, you know, I think people think it's really easy, and, you know, like anything, Mike, it just takes time and practice and stick-to-itiveness and tenacity and being willing to learn, and you fall down, you get up again. I guess it kind of depends on how badly you want it.
And with that, you become, I would imagine, a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
You're a graphic artist for a book cover. You're a formatter. You are the social media strategy hat wearer. You're the social media activator. You do it all. And does that change when that person then becomes discovered, or do you have to own a fair amount of that as you move through the process?
Well, I think a lot of people think it's, I think it's a misconception that when they get that book deal, they could just kick back and let everyone do the work for them. But I've heard this 100 times that it's just as hard. You're doing just as much work. The difference, I think, is, and I think Jack Carr probably does this, I know that I would do it. I've always been fanatical about learning every aspect so that I knew it, so that I could do it. Number one, so I could know how to do it. Number two, I remember the very first time I ever went to someone and wanted to get a website built, and he said it was like $3,000, and this was like 2 decades ago. And I'm like, I'll learn how to do it myself. And I sat down and taught myself how to do coding and WordPress and blah, 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 blah. And I've been that way ever since. The difference now is, and yeah, you're right, I plan the strategies, I do all the artwork for all the ads, I have done book covers, but I am now handing that off to great people like Raphael, who did The Imposter. And, you know, one day I want to get to the point, because I'm a leader and I like to run a team, which you don't do generally as a writer, and I would love to be able to eventually have a media person and a social person. And, you know, I want to hire you as my executive director of all of this one day at my first. I mean, this is, I daydream about this every single solitary day, folks, I promise you. And have you as a strategist and an executive producer, because of the way you can handle so many things. But that is so key, to have a team of people who get it, and their expertise is their expertise. But until then, you gotta put in the work. You gotta do it. I mean, I'm working on an audiobook right now for Frank Sirifo, and I'm gonna turn around and do my own audiobook for The Imposter. I did it for The Poser, and that did remarkably well in sales, even though somebody beefed me because I couldn't do a woman's voice. And I'm like, well, you got me there.
Everyone has an opinion.
Exactly.
People also commented on the sound effects in the audiobook of The Poser. They really liked that.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed that. I mean, again, that's the radio background showing up. And I've always liked radio theater. Even when I was a kid, I was listening to radio theater from the 30s and the 40s. And I love that medium. And I saw Don's eyes light up when we were having lunch that day, talking about the magic of radio. And the thing about radio is it's so personal. Like right here, you and I are within 6 feet of each other. And you know, we get to do it our way, and you get to connect on this level. And television's not that way, having worked in that. Film's not that way, having worked in that. Music's not that way. There is nothing like radio, which is why I think podcasts are so friggin' hot right now, because everyone thinks they can do it. And second of all, it's pretty easy to do it. The key is doing it well and doing it consistently. But anyway, yet I digress.
How about a little fun?
Yes, please do.
We're going to close tonight's podcast with some guilty pleasures.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to wipe that slate clean.
Okay.
Books, seriousness.
Yes.
And we're just going to be playful for our audience.
I love it. By the way, you're a great interviewer. You're a great host.
Well, thank you for letting me be your guest host this evening.
Yeah, you're amazing.
It was kind of funny to watch you relinquish control. Although you tried to hold on. But you let go.
Yeah. So what's the fun?
The fun is about guilty pleasures. So let's just talk about you live in Southern California.
Right.
Not in New York.
Right.
So clothing has definitely changed.
Oh my God, yeah.
What's your favorite clothing line and why?
Oh, wow.
Day to day, you get up, this is kind of your uniform.
Okay. My shorts are one of two things. They're either Vuori, which actually is based here in Encinitas. It is the best combination of materials, strategy, and wearability. It's phenomenal. And the other one is Prana, which is quality, And you think it's going to be yoga, but I think I got first introduced to them from our hiking days. But I like things that are durable because we beat them up and we wear them a lot. So that's the shorts. Shirts, how do you pronounce that shirt that I wear all the time, the long sleeve black shirt, Acerix or something like that?
Yeah.
I wear that entirely too much. And then the other one is what's that with the three stripes on my shoulder? I can't remember. But Viori's a big one, and then flip-flops are either rainbows or the ones I'm wearing right now.
I can't see that brand.
It's the one you called out the other day with a little smiley face. I can't read that little thing.
Oh, Sanuk.
Yeah. I think that's it. That's probably
Mac Weldon.
Mac Weldon's another good one for softness.
Casual, soft,
yeah.
Nice colors, nice fit. You don't feel like you've put on a one-size-fits-all tent.
No. Moving from New York to here was a huge difference, right? We're wearing wool and gabardine and polished cotton and just great shoes and sophisticated. And you come here, and if you're wearing dress shoes, people are like, you going to a funeral? I mean.
Well, that's the nice part of the style that Viori has created,
yes,
is that you can run around town in their apparel. You can take off shorts, put on a pair of jeans and one of their jackets and shirts, and you can roll into any restaurant and be appropriate.
And is it
still a little stylish?
Yeah, I really like Viori. Is Faherty, is that
how Faherty.
Faherty is another, talking about quality craftsmanship with the Southern, with the SoCal vibe, but with an East Coast influence.
Yeah, I see that in their marketing.
Yeah,
I can see that.
So good. So good.
Okay.
That was fun.
Favorite album. We're talking vinyl.
Oh my God. Okay.
Guilty pleasure. I'm at a board meeting at night. So you're here on your own. You're just going to.
Got it.
Not necessarily rock out, but you're just going to put on something. What is your go-to vinyl?
All right. Well, and if I had a tube-run Macintosh receiver with a really super high-end turntable, that would really make it. It's going to be, if I'm in a chill mood, it's going to be anything by Miles Davis, probably Some Kind of Blue is the first one that pops into my head. If I'm in a rocking mood, it's either going to be Boston, anything by Boston, Don't Turn Back, you know, any of those, or, okay, yeah, you didn't give me a multiple choice, Eagles, probably Hotel California, I never get tired of that album, anything by Boston, America is, if I want to just kind of chill, 70s style, it's America.
On that same vein, so now we're road tripping.
Right.
What is your favorite Sirius radio station?
Sirius XM 70s on 7 with PJ McKay, everybody. 70s on 7, and they all talk like that. It's 20 minutes after the hour. Yeah, 70s on 7.
That's been a good time.
It is. And Casey Kasem on American Top 40. Yeah. Oh, God.
All right.
I grew up with that. I love it.
What is it about the 70s for you that you connect with?
Oh, besides the fact that I grew up in them, it was the quintessential era of hip, great, earthy music coming from just people. Yeah, there was a lot of drugs and la la la, but it was just real true blue rock and roll. The Who, Guess Who, the Beatles, well, that was a little bit earlier, but Eagles, Rod Stewart, you know, I could just go on and on, but it's that organic, earthy. They were talented, great lyrics. Like, you can't not listen to Eagles or Elton John, Dan Fogelberg, James Taylor, and not hear really great stories. Just great frickin' stories. Like the stuff I'm listening to today, you know.
You've watched a fair amount of music documentaries over the course of the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Give me two that stand out to you and one that kind of took you by surprise.
Eagles, loved it. Couldn't get enough of it. The one that took me by surprise, the Bee Gees. I always liked the Bee Gees for what they were because that was such a specific sound that has never been done before or ever again. But I didn't have the vast appreciation until I saw that documentary. Wow. Amazing.
And that's the Bee Gees documentary on HBO. And the Eagles documentary was a two-parter on Showtime.
God.
We have it. I think you bought it.
I bought
for
it.
Me for my birthday or something.
And I could watch that. I could watch that once or twice a year without fail. It's like a couple of my favorite movies.
Okay, so last question.
Uh-huh. Yes.
It's a perfect night seasonally. You have a summer and you have a winter. Give me your cocktail and give me your dinner.
Oh, wow. For which season?
Summer, and then I want to know winter.
Summer is going to be a gin and tonic, and it's going to be, excuse me, it's going to be a Hendrix gin and Fever Tree light tonic with fresh limes. The dinner is going to be one of our favorites, lamb in a rosemary, etc. sauce on the grill, grilled to perfection, and probably with we're salad freaks, so some phenomenal salad, and I can eat broccoli all day long, so broccoli with a slight kind of a sauce on it. Winter, old fashions. Now, by the way, I don't drink either one of those very much anymore, or not in volume. I'm more of a craft beer person, and even then I'm kind of pulling back. But old fashions, and the dinner would be probably a ribeye, a baked potato with real butter, sour cream, chives, bacon bits, cheese, with a side of broccoli with butter and
Well, David, this has been a really special moment for me, and I appreciate you stepping back and letting me be your guest host, sitting here interviewing you on the day of your release of The Imposter and hearing the story about Pat and how she came to life and hearing all about this fantastic network of author friends that you've created for yourself, this wonderful group of people that now surrounds you. And as they support and lift you up, you support and lift them up. It's been a wonderful seat along the sidelines, watching all of this evolve and grow from the moment you came into my space in the fall of 2015. And I couldn't be more proud of you, and I couldn't be more excited for all that's in front of you. So for all of you that want to get to know David a little better and take a look at his books and take a look at his radio career and some fun other podcasts on Naked Monday and I think Rad Vibes Only and the Dave and Tammy Tour might still even be up there, give us your website one more time.
DavidTempleBooks.com.
Boom.
And P.S., you do realize that I couldn't do any of this without you.
Well, thank you.
There's going to be somebody who goes, oh, yeah, whatever. But it's true. Between you know, when we very first met, one of the very first questions you said, if you could do anything for a year, and we were both pursuing two different careers, and you said, if you could do anything for a year, what would it be? And I went, writing. And you said, do it. And I've been doing it ever since. I've been going at it as hard as I possibly can. And between that quote-unquote permission, so to speak, and your encouragement every step of the way, when I think I really suck some days, and you go, honey, here's your favorite phrase. Honey, you're a really good writer. And I know that's kind of like saying, hey, Marty, you like my book? But, you know, you're a well-read individual, and you have really good taste, and you have great instincts. And so, huge kudos to you, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for letting me into your space.
Yeah, it's been a great space, and it's so much better with you.
Thank you.
And what's your big finale, Miss Host of The Thriller Zone?
Who's your upcoming guest?
I'm glad you asked. Joe Goldberg, the author of The Spy Devils, will be on our next show on Friday, July 9th. He's going to be on the show, and we have some very cool guests lined up for the remaining Fridays of the month. But we'll just leave it with Joe Goldberg for right now. Very excited about that.
Excellent. Signing off from Encinitas, this is The Thriller Zone with David Temple.
The Thriller Zone has been presented by Blackstone Publishing and the exciting new techno-thriller 4 Minutes, now available from your favorite bookseller. Learn more at blackstonepublishing.com.